At Progressive, we know there's nothing like the feeling of riding a motorcycle with your crew on the open road. It's a primal, wild freedom. A feeling that would be impossible to recreate on the radio. Until now. Hit it, sound effects guy! No. You know, we really lost our stride at the end there. Get 24/7 roadside assistance with Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Roadside assistance subject to policy terms and limits and may require comprehensive coverage.
The Venture X card from Capital One gives you premium travel benefits, perfect for seeing Taylor Swift the Eras Tour. Presented by Capital One. Ooh, I do love her. Earn 5x miles on flights and 10x miles on hotels through Capital One Travel.
Enjoy your stay in Suite 13.
Whoa, 13? That's Taylor's lucky number. The Venture X card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello, I'm Denny Somach, and this is The Rock Podcast. Now, I'm a producer, rock historian, and best-selling author. And over the years, I've collected thousands of interviews. And I try and bring you the greatest stories as told by the artists themselves. On this episode, I dug out something that I think you'll enjoy. It's a rare, candid conversation with Pink Floyd's Nick Mason. Now, Nick is a founding member of the band and the only member that has appeared on every Pink Floyd album. David Gilmour, Rick Wright, and of course, Roger Waters have been absent on certain Pink Floyd albums. What's great about what you're going to hear is that Nick gives a history of the band, talks about their initial leader and chief songwriter, Syd Barrett, how David Gilmour joined the band, and why they didn't play Live Aid, meeting the Beatles at Abbey Road Studios while recording their first album, and the Beatles were recording Sgt. Pepper. All the stuff that as a fan you want to hear. Now, you may know that Nick has been touring with a band named Saucer Full of Secrets, which plays only early Pink Floyd material. He says he's happy to be playing Pink Floyd music fans may have never had the chance to experience live. The group was formed in 2018 by Mason, Spandau Ballet guitarist Gary Kemp, former Pink Floyd touring bassist Guy Pratt, guitarist Lee Harris, and keyboardist Dom Becken. They planned from the very beginning to play only songs Pink Floyd recorded before Dark Side of the Moon turned them into superstars. That material includes Syd Barrett tunes like Astronomy Domain and Arnold Lane, songs from David Gilmour's earliest days in the band like Childhood End and Fearless, and even the occasional classic like One of These Days and See Emily Play. In this interview, you'll hear him talk about how seeing Ginger Baker in Cream gave him inspiration for his career, who his favorite drummers are. Great stuff. So this is from the summer of 1985 when he had just released his solo album, Profiles, and shortly before Pink Floyd reformed without Roger Waters and released A Momentary Lapse of Reason in September 1987. So here it is. This is Nick Mason.
Polly, studying architecture. And during our first year there, someone, I think in the class, had written some songs and wanted a band to play the songs. And so he asked around the place, and we eventually admitted that we had played various instruments in the past. We got together and started messing about. And we just became a sort of small college band. In fact, I can remember we eventually played the songs to a well-known music publisher who said the songs showed some promise and the band didn't. So yeah, that was that. But sometime after that, Syd Barrett came down from Cambridge, who had been a friend of Roger's. And we then were all living in a flat together, an apartment. And one of our college lecturers moved from teaching us to an art school where they started up a light and sound workshop, and we started supplying music for that. So suddenly we got involved with the whole multimedia concept. And that's when things started to happen. We suddenly became rather fashionable. We were certainly rotten musicians and played dreadfully and everything else, but there was a sort of, you know, aura to it all. And things really sort of went on from there. we were generally rather behind with our abilities, you know, to the state of where we were getting professionally. But eventually it got to the point where there just was more and more work, and eventually we actually made a record and had a modest hit, mm-hmm. which put us into the sort of touring league where we could start touring the country and turn professional. Again, it's sort of reasonably well known. It was an absolute disaster. I mean, we were really loved in London, and that was sort of great and fashionable, but the style of our playing made us totally unsuited to working outside London, where we were looked upon as being the sort of biggest freaks and the most bizarre. And we had everything thrown at us, you know. We were absolutely unacceptable. We were the unacceptable Sound of Music.
Some of the greatest bands of all time started out being creatively ahead of where they were in their ability to execute what they were thinking of. And I think that's what you might be saying there. You had better ideas than you had the ability to get them across right away.
That's right, yeah. But somehow we seemed to... I think what's curious, looking back on it, is how much confidence we had. Because if one was treated like that now, you'd think, oh, this is horrible, you know, let's retire immediately.
How did the times, 64 through 69, for instance... I'm never cease to be amazed at how sociology contributes to rock and roll and vice versa. And I wonder if you could comment on the times, I see it referred to as acid rock and all that, the kids and the mental state of kids at the time. How did that contribute to the development of Pink Floyd?
Well, obviously, it was very important, because that's what was the launching pad, that we wouldn't have... they made an audience that considered what we were doing acceptable. I mean, I tend to say when asked about the 60s that I never saw the 60s, because I was always in the back of a transit van rushing up and down the motorway. But there was certainly an era where there was a certain spirit and there were a lot of new ideas around. It was almost, I think it happens now and again, it was like the previous occasion that had happened was the sort of the first teenagers, the post-war teenagers, where suddenly people had money and could afford a sort of lifestyle of their own, whereas previously everything happened when you got older.
Right.
And the 60s were another push forward to almost a sort of, perhaps a sort of slightly... I don't know. There was a sort of greater interest in ideas and concepts, and I think people were wrong in thinking that they could change the world that easily. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there was then a great disappointment afterwards. But there was certainly a very special spirit that came up at that time.
Do you have any influence at that time period who may have affected you? Now, I read that we weren't that in tune with things coming from America at the time.
Oh, no. I mean, for me, the great influence were the sort of early British, not psychedelic bands. For me, the thing that switched me from thinking I'd quite like to play professionally to I must do this was seeing Ginger Baker and the very first gigs from Cream. I mean, it absolutely changed my life. And the Yardbirds with Jeff Beck. I can remember them playing at our college, and just thinking, that's where I want to be. I mean, as soon as I saw it, I think he's a lovely player. I mean, really terrific. And I've enjoyed virtually all his records.
Returning to Syd Barrett, then, he came in and kind of gave the creative oomph to the band originally, and was the songwriter at the
absolutely,
outset.
Yeah, wrote and, virtually everything.
If I've seen one word about Syd constantly, it's erratic.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, at the beginning, he was not erratic at all. He was a very talented writer and good musician, nice guy to work with, and then he just went off the rails.
I believe you used unreliable in a former interview.
Well, that's probably a good word. I'll stick with it.
And so then there was quite a change in the band. I think the band seemed to find itself when Syd left, because suddenly you turned to Roger and you guys...
Well, I don't think it found itself. I mean, I think bands sometimes do have a sort of life of their own, and one person leaves and it changes direction. I think we had a fairly clear... I think we'd have been perhaps... in a way, would have probably still found the same sort of direction, but with a greater top 40 style of emphasis to it, which it had stayed. It's a little almost like Genesis with Peter Gabriel leaving. Suddenly, there's someone else who picks up and carries on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a bit what happened with us. Obviously, it switched the way the band worked and the emphasis of the music and so on. But in a way, I think things were established with Syd that were then sort of adjusted, rather than Syd leaving and us I'm only picking up on the idea of us finding ourselves, because it, it feels more like a development or a change rather than a sudden stabilization.
Okay. So Dave was brought in to originally augment Sid's thing.
That's right. We thought maybe we could operate a system where perhaps Dave came out on the road and Sid still wrote for the band, but it became unworkable. I mean, I think in those sort of situations, the politics very quickly accelerate to the point where everyone can't bear it.
How does the business of music get in the way of the love of music?
Well, I think now, being extremely old, that it's if one was sort of talking about how to deal with the business, with the business of business, the answer is it shouldn't at all. That the two are the two are linked, and the greater interest you take in your business, the better it is for you, because you can't just sort of pretend that it doesn't exist. It's very important to understand how it works and what your record company need and how to approach selling your record. You shouldn't, I mean, I would never suggest that it influences the music. The music should always be simply done. I mean, it's the only way most people know how to work, is to do the best work you can and then work out how the hell you sell it. But it's interesting, really, how one allows oneself to fall into a sort of state of feeling that, I don't know, your manager or your agent or your record company are your enemy and that they're working against you, and generally they're not. I mean, there are occasions when perhaps they are, but generally, the more you understand about what's going on, probably, in the long run, the happier you'll be. I mean, the most popular thing that's happened to so many people, including ourselves, is the business of pretending that the business doesn't exist and passing all sorts of things on to other people who then make a mess of it.
Yeah, sounds like the Apple story.
Absolutely, a good example.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like a pioneer? Like, I think people who are leaders don't actually know when they're doing it, but it takes perspective and time to realize that you were doing things that no one else had done. I referred to, you know, Quad Sound and Studios, and once again, the visual aspects of your shows.
Yeah, I mean, one never think, I still now wouldn't say we were leaders, because I think a lot of the tracks that we took were unique and were best not followed by other people. I mean, quadraphonic sound, the way we used it probably was I'm tempted to say roughly right. In a way, we used it for live shows, and that was about it. Quadraphonic sound came and went, really, to my understanding. It never really caught on as a recording system, and it certainly, I think, is a very, quite rightly, it was not ideally suited to sort of home use, because it's bad enough with stereo. I actually like to wander around when I'm listening to records, not sit in one place glued. And quad made, the positioning became absolutely critical. You know, there'd be these people sort of set in the middle of a room and the speakers arranged carefully around them. So I mean, that's a sort of example of something where one isn't really a leader. It's just something one comes up with and uses, that is there before anyone else, and then in fact everyone else decides to not to continue it.
Do you feel that some of the diversions you threw at the audiences may have put the band more in a background state than just like going to see a band?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, we became very the show became a sort of more grandiose theatrical event, and the individuals became relatively unimportant. This wasn't specific, you know, it wasn't that we particularly didn't want to become megastars in our own right. I mean, I think most people go into rock and roll initially because they do, but it just seemed the right way of putting the music across and doing things, and developed from that. And in fact, looking back on it again, it was actually a very pleasant way of going, because it meant that sort of our life off stage was so much easier.
And then Roger's concept of the wall took that to probably the ultimate by I understand that it all came out of a show in Olympic Stadium in Montreal, where it was, the fans were not what you would call receptive to what you wanted to play, and Roger originally came up with the concept of there is a divisor between fan and performer.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was to do with the fact that the audience, it wasn't that they didn't seem to have any, they were thrilled to be there and sort of enjoying the show, but not listening to it. And I think we suddenly realized that there was this extraordinary sort of wall between us, with one half thinking, you know, the band thinking they were doing one thing and the audience thinking it was something else. And so the wall was initiated with that, yeah.
And it could have actually worked in reverse, then, couldn't it? I mean, that could have served as a bond, I think, in the three times you did it, three times, right? The mm-hmm. wall. And in the three times that you've done it, I'm wondering if the fans felt more united by the fact that they couldn't see you.
Oh, I think it made a point. And the wall was put together in such a way that it wasn't sort of completely... Mm-hmm. It was about... I mean, without sort of trying to explain the whole show, it was... It was sort of fairly complicated system, so that there wasn't a wall all the time. In fact, of course, at the end of the show, the wall comes down, which right. is a very important point to make.
Right.
And in a way, the wall shows worked far better in terms of audience understanding than anything we'd done before. You know, there was a total sort of interest and understanding, and they didn't expect us to come on and play old hits or anything like that. It was much sort of... It worked.
And then did the filmic extension work, in your opinion?
I think so. I mean, I think opinions are divided on it, but I actually thought Alan Parker did a great job on it, and I thought Bob Geldof also was marvellous.
Really?
Mm.
That's
yeah.
good. Well, speaking of Bob, any comments on his latest endeavour, and were you at all approached for Live Aid?
No, we weren't, but Dave sort of represented us, which I thought was a nice thing, with Brian Ferry.
That's great.
I mean, it's a wonderful, great thing to have done, and a great credit to the music business that it could really do something that governments seem to have been unable to do.
I had heard last night on MTV there was some allusion to the fact that there may be a Pink Floyd, some type of reunion or something.
Well, there's no specific plan. All I've been saying, really, is that David and myself are now much more enthusiastic than we've been in the past to perhaps try and get back to doing a band album. Roger is not enthusiastic, in fact, deeply unenthusiastic at the moment, but I think things can change, and certainly Dave and I might sort of push a bit harder to do something.
Yeah, the band was never really split officially, was
it? Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I don't see any reason, as far as I'm concerned, I have absolutely no wish to announce its demise.
No,
reports of our death are exaggerated.
I'd like to ask you... how a drummer is a driver, and how the two things relate, and what are the similarities you see?
Well, to do both of them, you have to be a complete lunatic. So one's ideally trained. They complement each other, I suppose, is the answer. They have certain similarities. I mean, there's thrills, there's certain excitements, and sense of satisfaction afterwards, and so on, mm-hmm. And a certain amount of pushing yourself to do something. I think one of the interesting things is that motor racing, although it is a team sport to some extent, that you need a group of people to help prepare the car and run it and so on. And any success is absolutely dependent upon the car running well, apart from whatever you do as a driver. But unlike a band, after that, you are on your own, and it's something that's entirely personal. It's a great asset to people who work in a band to go on stage and know that they're going on with a group of people who they trust and know to be good, and it takes a lot of responsibility off you.
Right.
You know, it's a very much a shared thing. So motor racing is an exercise where suddenly you are totally dependent upon your own abilities, and there's no one there to help you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one reason why it complements it.
Yeah, it seems to me that keeping the rhythm and the tempo of a band together is very much the same thing as navigating a track.
Yeah, so I mean, if one wants to get a bit sort of precious about it, I think you can actually say, well, it's almost like playing a piece of music going around a track, and it's just that you can't go back and practice bar by bar. You've got to play through the whole piece again and again and again, and it's as difficult to get right. And I mean, I always maintain that motor racing is closer to golf as a sport than a lot of people would ever imagine, because although people think of motor racing as sort of smoke and fumes and blood and thunder, there's a lot of precision in it, and to drive a car properly round a track quickly is about absolute precision and making your turns, getting them exactly right. It's not a matter of sort of hurling the car madly round the place. It's about getting the car turning in exactly the right point at the right speed, because as soon as you get it wrong, you start not necessarily spinning off and having accidents, you just get slower.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how your fascination with motor racing began.
Well, really through my father, who made motor racing films and used to race himself. And I was taken to watch motor racing from when I was 6 or 7 years old. And so I've always been interested in it.
So you went to the track to see your dad work on
That's right. Yeah.
I guess that could be how your interest in film got started as well.
Sure, yeah.
pretty fairly obvious, I'd say. Let me see. Pink Floyd has been involved in, we talked about The Wall, but there was also the Pompeii film as well.
Yep. It's a long time ago.
That was combination studio interview documentary and things like that. Any remembrances or anything that you thought would happen as you were making it that did or did not happen now that you look back on it almost 11, 12 years later?
I think when we made Pompeii, it was very much one of those. We didn't take much interest in the making of it. I mean, we took a bit, but looking back on it, I mean, we were just more or less directed. Whereas, obviously, if one went back to it now, one would take a much greater interest in it. Mm-hmm. I think it's surprising, really, how well it works, he said modestly. By which I mean, looking at, certainly up until recently, when concert videos and so on have become much more sophisticated, I think the thing that Adrian Marben, who made the film, got right was to film it in the open air, because what could have been a sort of just ploughing through the piece without an audience again and again actually took on a character because of the wind and the dust and the night and everything else. So we actually played as with some feeling, which I think was very important. I think, in fact, that there's some studio stuff, I think it's Cav with an X, that we play in it, that's really very dull compared to whatever the Source Full of Secrets, I think, which is played, as I say, with much more feeling to it.
Did you see anything film-wise before you went into that that either, like, did throw up, like, I don't want to do it like that, or I'd like to do it like that, referring to, say, things like the Beatles romp, obviously you wouldn't want to do.
No, I don't think we'd ever seen ourselves in that sort of light, right. And the way the film was much more a sort of documentary. Mm-hmm. Idea.
How do you think it stands up?
It was quite well, really. I mean, I still absolutely can't bear to watch it. I'm deeply ashamed, but that doesn't mean that it's not okay, really.
I have a quote here that says, I'd like to be part of group activities and I don't demand to be in control. That came from you, I mm-hmm. think.
Yeah, that sounds like modest old me.
Yeah, it's a very unselfish posture. And not one that everyone gets into. Do you think that has helped your longevity and your perspective?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I suppose it's always helpful to have... it's certainly a sort of easier base to work from than thinking one always has to be in control. I mean, it is the thing, I think, with working with other people, of trying to sort out systems whereby people do what they're good at and everyone understands who's good at what and lets them get on with it. I think it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, I think it's difficult in all walks of life. And one doesn't get it right all the time. I'm sure I still think I'm really good at things that actually I'm not very good at.
A bit on the dark side of the moon. I had heard you say in another interview that you, even though it was received 10 times better than everything that preceded it, you didn't think it was 10 times better than everything that preceded it.
That's right.
But still today, it is an absolute audio classic. It's an event on record. And I was wondering your comments or your thoughts on it.
Well, I think I'm probably a bit stunned, really. You know, I don't... You know, it's not as though I can sit here saying, yeah, well, it's such a good idea. It's quite obvious that... quite obvious why it's there. I think it is a bit of a phenomenon that people are fascinated as to why it's been there that long, and so perhaps go and buy it almost out of interest. Certainly some people have bought second copies and third copies and so on. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to happen, but I don't truly understand why, because I think the idea still stands up very well. There's some songs on it that still more or less stand up. I mean, I'm inevitably deeply ashamed of the drumming on it and listen to it and think, oh god, I could do it so much better now and I'd do it differently. But no, it's one of those sort of very, very curious things.
Can you explain about the hypnotic aspect of the cover?
In a word, no. The cover was executed by some friends of ours called Hypnosis, who did virtually all our covers after the first one through for a sort of 12-year period, something like that. And we simply asked them to come up with a cover idea for us, and they came up with various ideas, and that was one of them, and we all immediately fell in love with it. It was just such a beautiful graphic image. I mean, I think record covers sometimes have to do some explaining of a record, and sometimes they can simply be an attractive image, you know, that just says, look at me, please buy me. And that, in a way, just did both. There was something there which I couldn't really explain. I mean, it's a sort of abstract, it's whatever you want to make of it, but it works. It does relate to the record, but it's also just a very straightforward, clean, attractive image.
How much imagination do you like, or how much imaginative interpretation do you like to leave up to the listener?
Oh, as much as possible. I mean, I think it's people do constantly try and get us to explain things, and I think that's such a pity. I mean, I do feel that it's wrong to think of the music as being difficult or avant-garde or, you know, hard in any way. It's not difficult music at all. It's fairly romantic, really, if anything. And it's simply, I mean, one of the things I was saying was it's a little like looking at a painting. I mean, you don't need the artist to write out an essay on what you're really seeing and who that was in the cornfield and, you know, all the rest of it, and what the name of the driver of the hay wagon is or something like that. You just look at it, and the artist saw something very specific there, which he's done. But what you get from the painting is something else. There's, you know, some other feeling from it. And it's that. I mean, there's an idea, and people should then take that and respond to it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There are some songs that I hear that I absolutely love that I do not want to see a video as, because I cherish my own mental picture of what it was, and that's personal. And, you know, as good as somebody else's interpretations and execution could be, it still isn't mine. And that's what I like most about Floyd, is because you can wrap up on it like a warm, semi-depressed blanket sometimes, and let yourself make your own conclusions. How do you feel if Roger is somewhat voicing his depression at various stages of your recording career, but you don't necessarily feel that bad about things?
No, I certainly don't, but I've always been sympathetic to Roger's lyrics. I mean, I've never felt like saying, well, this is Roger's feelings and not mine and so on, because I think that the genuine looks at sensations that I've certainly felt, even if I'm not feeling them now, and that there's a lot of room in music to make some other statements apart from gotta 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 get your babe, which, you know, is a very important statement, and but it doesn't need to be repeated all the time, and it's quite nice to have a look at sort of the downside of life sometimes. And certainly some of the things in Roger's lyrics relate to the people who listen to records. I think it's also unfair to say that, you know, Roger's been accused of whinging about life when he's sort of obviously doing so well. You know, I think it's perfectly reasonable to make statements and say things. And certainly music should be used for it more. I mean, I was quite interested in the Paul Hardcastle single, 19, because it felt like a sort of very short, easy to digest little message about something, about a piece of real life.
Yeah.
Rather like a little sort of collage.
I often think of Townsend and what Roger Daltrey had to interpret through Pete's pensive thinking, and then he gives this self-exploration to Daltrey to sing, and I always thought it was an amazing.
And I think it works very nicely. I think it's a sort of, again, it's almost that thing of saying, well, look, here's an idea, now let's translate it through Roger Daltrey rather than directly through Pete, and you get another angle on it, but it's the same, you know, it's the same message.
On the Beatles.
I mean, they're probably the, all by, without doubt, the most important band that's ever been. Who knows if anyone would ever? I can't believe that anyone will become more important than them, because partly because rock and roll has changed in its sort of social stature now, that the Beatles were news, big news, most of their existence. Everything they did and said was important. And the media now has almost moved on to the point where, you know, rock music is okay, but it's not that important. Mm-hmm. Really, it's so much part of everyday life now. It's not such a phenomenon anymore. So that's one angle, one aspect of it.
Did news of them land on your doorstep as you were beginning in your music career?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was saying to someone else had asked about Beatles, and I was saying that I very clearly remember when we were recording our first album at Abbey Road, the Beatles were recording Sgt. Pepper next door, and we were ushered in to meet the great ones at one point, and, you know, that was pretty important stuff.
And they were doing Pepper at the time?
Yeah, they were doing, yeah, exactly.
Ooh. Drummers past and present that you admire?
Lots of jazz drummers, sort of what almost fusion drummers, Billy Cobham in particular. Doesn't mean he has no influence on me whatsoever because I can't play like that, mm-hmm. but like to listen to him. Ginger Baker, big influence, just in terms of, you know, being up there, even not necessarily even again the playing of. I mean, there's just so many drummers. I think you listen to all the time, looking for things that you'd like to play or that you think are clever and interesting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's in the time when one's starting off, one's perhaps a bit more geared to the idea of listening to other people. I mean, there were four or five drummers when I was starting who were an influence on me, partly because I got to know them a little bit and was astonished at how helpful they were. I was thinking particularly of Mitch Mitchell, mm-hmm. when he was playing with the Hendrix Experience. Blinky Davidson, who was with the Nice. Mm-hmm. And Robert Wyatt, all of whom I thought were great drummers. And all were extremely sort of friendly, and, you know, there was a feeling that you could actually watch them and think about how they did it, and mm-hmm. and go away and think again about what they were doing. And
what's the best thing a drummer can bring to any band?
Can bring to
any band. What is his role, and how can he maximize it?
The same as virtually anyone else in a band, which is a sense of the band and an ability to see how to fit into the band, rather than a desperate wish to become the great solo star of it. I mean, I have a particular dislike, which are the sort of 20-minute drum solos, because I think they serve little purpose and they're more a gymnastic exercise generally than musical. But it's really to have a sympathy, particularly with the bass player, to be able to set patterns that work well, mm-hmm. for the soloists. Don't do as I say, because I certainly at times have been accused, particularly by the rest of the band, of playing far too much and getting far too excited. But that's just that's life.
That's our conversation with Nick Mason on this edition of The Rock Podcast. His Saucer Full of Secrets band released a live album and video live at the Roundhouse. If you'd like information on that as well as tour dates, go to Nick's website, thesaucerfullofsecrets.com. Now, I hope you enjoyed hearing this interview from my archives. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And you can find us at the website, therockpodcast.com, and on Facebook. You can also send your comments and let me know what you think. Contact me at hello@therockpodcast.com. That's it for now. So long.
This week on RVER, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm sorry, I can't operate on that vehicle.
But doctor, you took an oath.
That RV, it's my son's RV.
Oh, doctor, isn't there anything you
can do? I'm not a miracle worker, Sheila. I'm an RV surgeon, trained to save the lives of large injured recreational vehicles, which is definitely a real profession.
When your RV really needs saving, Progressive has you covered. See if you could save with a leader in RV insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Covered subject to policy terms.
The Venture X card from Capital One gives you premium travel benefits, perfect for seeing Taylor Swift the Eras Tour. Presented by Capital One. Ooh, I do love her. Earn 5x miles on flights and 10x miles on hotels through Capital One Travel.
Enjoy your stay in Suite 13.
Whoa, 13? That's Taylor's lucky number. The Venture X card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.